Hey everyone, and welcome to episode one of That Gives Me Anxiety, a podcast about the things that make us anxious, fearful, afraid, and then we talk about them. My name is Patrick Jones. I've been a journalist for the last 10 years in New York City, and I've also done some improv and sketch comedy as well. Though I guess I can't really claim New York City as my home anymore, because as of a few weeks ago, I moved down to Charleston, South Carolina, which has been fun, exciting, and let's be honest, caused me extreme anxiety. Just the U-Haul situation alone was enough. But okay, let's talk about this episode and the series in general. In fact, every other episode besides this one will be about a particular topic that causes anxiety or irks someone. And I've invited those people to come on and talk about what scares them and joke around about it. And in a lot of cases, I've also brought on an expert. For example, there's an episode upcoming about job interviews. And so I invited the CEO of The Ladders to come on and help everyone find ways to be a little bit more confident and less anxious when they do have a job interview. Or I did an episode on deep water or fear of being around deep water. And in that episode, I invited a hypnotist as the expert. But for this episode, I thought it would be important to establish what anxiety is and get a better understanding of what's going on inside our brains when we are feeling anxious and things we can do to help ourselves. Just a way of setting the tone for the rest of the series. And to do that, I invited a friend that I know through improv comedy, Dylan Geislers, who has expressed for years that he's had issues with anxiety. And to help us understand anxiety itself, I also interviewed a professor from the University of North Carolina. Before we get to the show, I just want to let you know that today's episode is brought to you by My Software Tutor. Can Excel be my friend? Many people have wondered this for years. The answer is yes, it can. My Software Tutor offers three levels of real-time Zoom-based courses with a live instructor. They all deliver practical, functional business skills in a friendly, supportive environment. These courses will increase your marketability, whether you're an employee, job seeker, consultant, or contractor. Register at mysoftwaretutor.com and use the promo code POD20 to save 20% off all registrations. Today's episode is also brought to you by The Cardist. With so many birthdays, there's no time to shop for cards. Write the cards and buy the stamps. Now you can do it all right where you sit because The Cardist Studio does it for you. Introducing a writing specialist for the message inside your greeting cards. The Cardist Studio creates your message, writes it in the card, and mails it for you. All you do is pick the card and tell why you're sending it. No more errands, no more anxiety. For a message from your heart, but not your hands. Sit back and just enjoy your relationships. TheCardistStudio.com. Thoughtful, just got easy. I'd also like to say to please look for the show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And to please, if you're liking the show, rate and review it. That's really helpful. And to also mention my other podcast. It's called Death Space Filling the Void, and it's about death, dying, grief, and life. Season one of that show, which is 5 episodes, is up, and you can get it wherever you get your podcasts from. All right. Let's jump into episode one of That Gives Me Anxiety. Thank you so much for listening, and let's do it. Joining me today is my friend, Dylan Geislers, who's a comedian, and you've probably seen him in a bunch of commercials with Keegan-Michael Key. He was also in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which everyone loves. Dylan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on is that you've always been kind of lighthearted about the fact that you have anxiety. And the first episode of this podcast, I wanted to focus on anxiety itself and kind of getting to the root of what anxiety is.
Yeah, I feel like for me, it didn't really start until I would say I had it here and there as a kid, but never to the point where it was like debilitating, where like I would just hide in the corner. I think maybe it started to get really bad maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, mm-hmm. when I was at the height of like doing improv all the time and having a show every week, and just I think getting burnt out from that. And after every show, you're doing all these shows with a different group of people every night. So after every show you do, it's always a party because everybody wants to celebrate for every reason under the sun. Yeah. And so that there's like a lot of drinking and like partying involved with that. And so I think it mostly stems from that and like having to be on all the time.
Right, because in the bar, you're also quote unquote performing surrounded by everyone else that just did improv, because improv people tend to not know when to turn it off.
Yes, exactly. And I love to perform, but then like sometimes you're on a group with people who maybe didn't realize that you had a bad show, and then you bow and then you go backstage and you're like, hey, great job, everyone. When in your head, I know that it was a bad show. But I feel bad saying that to the other performers because
right. Someone on your team had a great show. Yeah.
Right. And I would just sound like a jerk. So I feel like it probably stems from that, like getting in my head, which I know is like a cardinal rule of what not to do in improv. But after doing it 4 or 5 years, I think I just got tired of it. And I just started zoning out every show. Could you tell?
No, you're a terrific improviser. But I completely agree with you about improv. And I feel like, racing from one part of New York City to do improv to a bar in Brooklyn where people are just having drinks and don't want an improv show, it just builds anxiety. And, you know, it's funny. It's like the least behind the music form of anxiety is like, I have anxiety because I performed improv in a basement for free.
Well, also, too, I think that just generally working in the entertainment industry, everything, like I've chosen a career path that is very uncertain. And then not only am I facing rejection, going to auditions throughout the week, but then I have to go like bomb every other improv show.
Have to bomb.
It's a requirement. Well, no, I mean, I had good shows here and there, but it's just like living in New York for the last 8 years, constantly like go, 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 go. And working all these random side gigs, I feel like I never had time to take a step back and like breathe and relax.
I agree. And not really like even fully acknowledging that I had a lot of anxiety. They're just like are serious like health implications.
And, yeah.
You know, it's pretty taxing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've gone to the emergency room before just because I was freaking out so much. It mimics symptoms of like a heart attack.
Yeah,
so I automatically just think the worst. Oh, I'm dying. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, you're like
snowballs and
like, well, I didn't need to do this. I didn't need to come here. But I don't know, it's tough. You can't just bottle it up is what I've learned. And you can't self-medicate.
Well, I haven't introduced this yet, but since each episode is going to have a different topic, and my goal is to sort of demystify everything. Prior to our discussion, I interviewed a professor from the University of Carolina, Professor John Abramowitz, who is a professor of anxiety. And he had a lot of interesting things to say and really kind of transformed how I view my anxiety. So I think we should go to the first clip.
Okay. Go Tar Heels.
Now joining the podcast, I have Professor Jonathan Abramowitz, who's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, editor-in-chief, Journal of Obsessive Compulsive and Related Disorders, and the author of 2 books, Getting Over OCD and Exposure Therapy for Anxiety. Professor, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me, Pat.
Yeah. So just sort of jumping right in, what is anxiety?
Sure. Great question. Anxiety, first of all, I should say that anxiety is something that everyone experiences, not only humans, but every member of the animal kingdom has this kind of fear, anxiety, stress response. And the reason that we all have that is it protects us from harm. So we all know what the fight or flight response is. It's this response that takes over when we perceive some sort of threat. All of a sudden, our body responds in a way to help us to protect ourselves from danger. And this is really what anxiety is, kind of scientifically. It's the fight or flight response. In the olden days, when we were out there among the saber-toothed tigers and all of that, humans who are slower and weaker and you know not as strong as these other predators, we needed something to kind of give us an advantage so that, you know, we would become afraid if we saw or heard an impending tiger, and we would either fight for our lives or run away. And so fundamentally, anxiety is there to protect us. It's our kind of inbuilt danger detection alarm system.
It's interesting to think, you know, going back using the saber-toothed tiger reference, like that's how it developed. And now, you know, I feel anxious when I'm around too many new people that I don't really know. It's just funny to see how it's developed over time. Has anxiety changed?
So fundamentally, it has not changed. Why we need it now absolutely has changed. So fortunately, most of us, not all of us certainly, but most of us don't live in life or death situations on a daily basis. We don't encounter that. So we don't need it in the same way that our ancestors did. But as you mentioned, if I didn't have at least a little bit of anxiety before coming on this podcast, right? Yeah. I might be cocky. I wouldn't be prepared. And so it does help us. It helps us in social situations, job interviews, taking exams. You need a certain amount of, you know, of anxiety. And we know that there's kind of a zone of a moderate amount of anxiety that makes us do our best.
Interesting. I had never heard of anxiety being described as like there being a zone of it being productive, but that makes perfect sense, right? I had anxiety too. Like this podcast is new and I wanted to make sure I was prepared and ready and had good questions for you. And that definitely caused me to do a better job. But, you know, there's a level of anxiety and certainly people who have anxiety that affects their day-to-day lives in a extremely negative way. How does that come about?
Right. So people who have clinically severe anxiety, what they're doing is they are perceiving threat when they don't need to be. It would be like a car alarm going off when there's just a strong gust of wind, right? There's not actual danger, but they're perceiving some sort of threat. And I mean, we all do this from time to time. Every one of us can point to a time when we've been anxious or worried about something and then it didn't end up being dangerous. Right. For folks who have clinical anxiety that gets in the way, they unfortunately fall into some habits, we can talk about those, that kind of keep them habitually perceiving threat. There's probably some biological predisposition there too. And then they have certain ways of managing that fear that kind of backfires on them and makes the whole problem into a vicious cycle.
What is physically going on in our brains when we're experiencing anxiety?
Yeah, great question. So what happens when we perceive a threat through one of our, you know, senses, our brain sends a message to our adrenal glands, which are kind of in our lower back near our kidneys, and that stimulates the release of adrenaline, right? And we all know what adrenaline is. It's that kind of pumped up feeling.
Right.
That is the chemical of anxiety. And so what happens in our brain, there's a mental kind of a cognitive brain response. There's a physical response. As well. In our brain, automatically, we're going to pay attention to whatever we're afraid of. There's a shift in attention. So if I'm worried about my boss comes in and says, hey, we got to talk at the end of the day, then, right. You know, if I feel threatened by that, that's all I'm going to be able to think about, right? When we get worried about stuff and it gets in the way of our sleep, it gets in the way of our appetite, it gets in the way of our concentration on other things because, again, you don't want to be daydreaming if there's a saber-toothed tiger nearby. You want to be focused in on the danger, right? So that, again, that's protective. But right. What also happens is that adrenaline signals our heart to start beating really fast and our lungs to try to take in as much oxygen as possible. And the purpose of that is, again, for fighting and fleeing, we need more oxygen. Our muscles burn oxygen as energy. So let's get that oxygen in. Let's pump it around to the different parts of the body. And there are lots of other physical changes. We sweat, lots of other physical changes as well. A lot of people mistake those for like, I'm having a heart attack.
Oh, yeah. It can feel so real. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And that's what a panic attack is. It feels like something terrible is happening. But really, what it is just your good old fight or flight response doing what it's supposed to do. But sometimes it's a false alarm.
Just kind of like misfiring in a sense. Is that an accurate way of describing it?
Well, it's accurate in that it's firing when we don't need it to fire, but it's doing what we want it to do. It's like the smoke alarm. When the smoke alarm goes off because, you know, you're burning something in the toaster, right? The smoke alarm is doing what it's supposed to be doing, right? It's just that it's a false alarm because
right, we can handle that. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, that's great. That's good to know.
So what'd you think? You know, I think to me, it's interesting to think of it as just your fight or flight response, right?
Yeah. I almost wanted that to keep going. I was so enthralled with that. I really liked the saber-toothed tiger reference. That, like, this isn't something, it's like a key word right now. Like, it's in the zeitgeist, like anxiety. And, oh, that this is a trigger. That's a trigger. That seems like something that has just come up within the last 2 or 3 years. But in reality, this is something that has been happening since prehistoric times.
Right. That's a good point. I wasn't even thinking about it that way. But yeah, when you just think of it as a fight or flight response, I don't know. It just seems to ground it and just make it seem like something I can handle a bit more.
Yeah. And I thought what he said about the daydreaming aspect, I thought that was really interesting too, because I find myself daydreaming a lot. And that's how you start overthinking things. And you really have to stay in the present as much as possible.
With daydreaming too, I feel like, you ever see the cartoon Doug?
Yeah.
I feel like Doug.
One of my favorites.
Okay, good. Then you'll get the I was like, if he doesn't get this reference, this whole thing is
going to No, I liked the Nickelodeon version. And yes. Then there was that other Disney version. And that one I never watched.
Trash.
Because why would you?
Right.
Why would you even bother?
Don't waste your time. The reason why I bring that up is, like, he's daydreaming, he gets himself into a scenario with Roger or Patty, and then ends up envisioning the whole town laughing at him. Or, you know,
yeah, maybe that's where my anxiety comes from, is Doug funny.
We've been talking a little bit back and forth about causes of anxiety for us individually, and that's something I talked about with Professor Abramowitz. So what are the health implications in both the short and long term for people who suffer from anxiety?
So in the short term, kind of short term anxiety, panic, fight or flight, again, not dangerous at all. It wouldn't make any sense for nature to give us this life-saving fight or flight mechanism that then harms us, right? So yeah. You know, again, people think, when they have panic attacks, when they become very anxious, I'm losing control, I'm going to faint, I'm going to have a heart attack. If you were afraid of a saber-toothed tiger back in the day and you fainted because there was a real saber-toothed tiger, then humans wouldn't be here, right? So it's safe. It's not going to hurt you. That short-term burst of fight or flight is kind of similar to exercising. It's what happens when we exercise. And we all know, you know, what exercise is supposed to do for our bodies. So it's not dangerous at all. In the long run, and so we're talking about decades and decades over time of consistent stress, mm-hmm. That's something that our body wasn't meant for. And so we're talking, again, 50, 60 years, then it can have some negative consequences, the breaking down of organs, because, again, your body's working overtime when you're in the fight or flight response.
It's so interesting to hear you describe anxiety in this positive sense, like, to me, and how it's used, it's this big negative thing, like, oh my God, I'm so anxious.
Yeah, you know, I love that you're bringing that up, because that's something in my clinical work with patients. They come in, they've been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, and they come in saying, you got to get rid of this anxiety, I can't handle it. And of course, we wouldn't want to do that, because we need our anxiety. Next time you're crossing the street, and a car or a truck is blaring its horn at you, you need that anxiety. What we want to do, and what kind of the contemporary cognitive behavioral approaches to helping people with clinical anxiety, problematic anxiety, is about helping people to have a better relationship to their anxiety and to learn that it's manageable. Do we want to reduce it and so it's not kind of firing at times when they don't need it? Absolutely. But part of doing that is teaching them that they don't have to be afraid of their own anxiety.
It's almost like that we shouldn't necessarily be wrestling with our anxiety. It's like anxiety and ourself both want the same thing, right?
That's exactly right. And when we start to wrestle with anxiety, that's the game is rigged. We cannot win that game.
Right.
And lots of people run into trouble. That's one of the underlying pieces to clinical anxiety, to problematic, you know, anxiety.
Right. So stop fighting it, just sort of rolling with it. Okay, great. Let's talk about what can make anxiety worse for an individual. Are there behaviors or foods, or I want to hear your thoughts.
Great question. I think that probably the biggest contributor is the things that we tell ourselves. We all have this internal dialogue that's always going on in our head. We're always, you know, somebody brings food and we think to ourselves, oh, that looks really good, right? Or we meet someone and we say, eh, I don't think I like that person.
All the time.
All the time. And it turns out that there are certain things that people do habitually that can make them feel more anxious, because anxiety, again, is tied to that perception of threat. So the tendency to overestimate the likelihood of something bad happening. In layman's terms, we call that jumping to conclusions.
Right.
I just know I'm going to fail the test. I just know she's not going to like me. You know, she's going to get sick and die, you know, of coronavirus or something like that. When we make these predictions without any evidence, and we all know people that do this habitually, right?
Yes.
They're the people that tend to be more anxious. The other thing is overestimating the catastrophe. So the, you know, it would be awful. It would be 101% terrible if this happened. I couldn't cope with it. You know, is another thing. So I think that those are the most important things. But we know that people, when they have trouble with their sleep, they're more apt to have stress and anxiety. People who have poor diets, that tends to influence stress and anxiety. And actually, exercise really is important in helping people to manage their anxiety. So I think those things. And then I also think, and I think there's some good research evidence to bear this out as well, there's probably just some sort of temperament, whether that's genetics or otherwise, some sort of biological temperament. There's some people, they're born with their fight or flight, their anxiety system just kind of dialed up a little more than others. We all know people that are just kind of more chill, and then others that are a little bit more high strung. And to some extent, we have those limits of biology that kind of constrain us to that one way or the other.
Yeah, I've always been so jealous of people who are just described as chill. It's like, I don't know, maybe it's New York or my genetics, but I've always just been like, this, we need to do this and then that and then this. And then I definitely drive my girlfriend crazy sometimes with my anxiety.
Yes, I mean, some of that is biology and some of that is probably the environment too. I think it's a hopeless combination of lots of different factors.
Right. Something that you mentioned in terms of sleep and diet, is it just if our body's not getting what it needs, how does your body not getting what it needs then turn to fight or flight?
That's a great question. I would say that when we don't sleep as well, we don't have the resources to be able to manage stress. Our thinking, our cognition is more impaired. We're not getting, you know, rest helps us to kind of regenerate and helps our brain to function during the day. We need that. There's lots of studies showing that. Mm-hmm. And so the ability to be able to feel confident and not fall into some of those thinking traps is greatly influenced by sleep. And I think exercise too helps us get oxygen to our brain and to our bodies, makes us feel like we've accomplished something. There probably are, you know, brain differences when people exercise that I'm not an expert completely on how all that works, but there are people who do know all of that. And the research is really good that people who, and again, it's a correlation, so it could go either way. Maybe people who are less anxious exercise more, or that exercise helps a person to reduce their stress. It's probably a little bit of both. And certainly we know that diet has a lot to do with anxiety and stress. The things that we put in our body, they help to make us up and influence mood to a great extent. We know that people who have a lot of anxiety, they fall into a vicious cycle of then kind of eating lots of comfort foods to try to make them feel more comfortable. But then those are also the foods that are high in sugar and high in fat, and they're not good for us. They can actually make us feel anxious, depressed, things like that in the long run.
I had some chunky peanut butter before this interview. All right, great.
I eat a lot of peanut butter. I don't know.
Man, that was just like a checklist to my anxiety.
Especially going back to like when we were talking about our improv days, just like wasn't sleeping, eating like crap. I ate Bravo pizza before every single show.
Oh, yeah. Lots of pizza and just staying out with friends till the sun came up twice a week sometimes, maybe more.
Right.
It's not healthy. And since performing less, I've been less anxious. But since cutting back on doing those sorts of things, then I have noticed in myself being less anxious. And even during the shutdown and quarantine and all that with the coronavirus, I've actually found myself to be less anxious, anxiety ridden over the course of the last 5 months or whatever. I think I was a little stressed out in the beginning about it, but you kind of just have to take things as they come and roll with the punches. And yeah. One thing that from this clip that I liked was what he said about consistent stress. Like if you're just doing something consistently, then it's just something is building. Right. You have no way to release that. And I think a good example of that is scrolling endlessly through your phone. And over the last 4 years, like 4 years ago, 8 years ago, when I was a kid, there wasn't this constant stream of the news and what is going on in politically. And now that's just like in your face wherever you turn. And I have always liked reading the news and staying informed and just like reading about current events, whatever. But like you can't do it all the time, all day, every day, because you'll drive yourself crazy.
Well, I used to work at Cheddar and just being up to date about every single news story, it's just not healthy for you.
And on top of that, you had to reach certain view quotas for every single thing you made. And over time, that just wears on you mentally. Now that I've stepped away from Cheddar, it's just a lot easier to
handle my anxiety. Though I will say, I'm happy to hear that you're doing a little bit better with the shutdown. But I would say, like, still having a hard
time. Probably the complete opposite for a lot of people, but...
Yeah, well, that's great. Hey, it's not like we're rooting for you to be like, you got to be like us. You got to be in pain and suffering. How dare you?
I had heard you say you get it here and there, but I never knew it was that serious.
I think there's like, it's just like something you don't really want to talk about. You just...
Nobody wants to be the Debbie Downer of the group and like constantly saying like, well, I'm anxious about this. I didn't get this. I didn't do this. And this sucks and blah, blah, blah. Because right. Then nobody will want to even be around you.
Right. Eeyore is adorable in Winnie the Pooh, but like in reality, I don't think people really want to hang around Eeyore that much.
Yes. Nobody wants an Eeyore. I like too what he said, like thinking about it all the time. Like if you're thinking about getting a panic attack, then you're probably going to get a panic attack.
Right.
Luckily, I don't do that anymore, but there in the maybe a few years ago, I've been known to be a bit of a hypochondriac. And so what he was saying, like every little thing can't possibly give you a panic attack or anxiety. You need to like suck it up sometimes.
Yeah. Or not feed into it, right? It's like, I almost look at it like a Freddy Krueger thing where he can't get you if you don't believe him. Well, cool. The final clip is obviously about resources to handle anxiety, and this is a good time to hear what he had to say.
What is exposure therapy for anxiety, referencing your book?
Yeah. Exposure therapy, remember how we were talking before about leaning into anxiety? Mm-hmm. Exposure therapy is a technique in the kind of broader umbrella of cognitive behavior therapy. And it's a technique where we help people to face their fears about things that are not realistically dangerous. So, you know, if you're afraid of dogs, for example, dogs are generally safe, not 100%, nothing's 100% safe. But, you know, if you play the statistics, dogs are unlikely to be dangerous. And so people who are afraid of dogs need to learn this. And you can't just talk someone out of that. For 100 years, we've been doing talk therapy where we just try to convince people they don't have to be afraid of dogs. The likelihood is low and all this, or trying to figure out where it came from. What was your potty training that made you afraid of dogs? And that's a lot of BS. Instead, what it takes is actually going and being around a dog and having predictions, right? So I am afraid this dog is going to bite me. And then being surprised when after spending an hour or three with a dog, the dog doesn't bite you. And then you try it again on another day with another dog and you learn even more. And the more you repeat that, the person, by leaning into their fear, the person learns a couple of things. Number one, that the situation isn't as dangerous as they thought. And number two, that the anxiety feelings that they have, that we were talking about earlier, that those aren't dangerous and that they're temporary and that the person can manage those. It's very effective treatment when it's done the right way.
That's a very interesting point. I'm an anxious flyer, and you know, a lot of times people be, you know, it's safer to drive, or it's safer to fly than drive to the airport, or you know, it's the safest mode of travel. All true, but that doesn't really make me feel better. It makes me feel possibly worse, where it's just these people are like talking at me. And what does help is times when I'll fly fairly often, right? And it sort of, again, demystifies the anxiety I have about flying, because it just becomes more routine.
You're doing exposure therapy.
Let's talk about any other solutions for anxiety that you'd like to mention.
Well, so cognitive behavior therapy, exposure therapy really is the way to go. There are medicines that people are sometimes prescribed. It's a little bit of trial and error. We don't know exactly how they work, and they work, some work really well for some people and not so well for others. We don't understand that exactly. I also think that, like we were talking about before, exercise, healthy diet, and sleep are so important. Alone, those three things aren't going to cure a fear of dogs or a fear of flying, but they certainly help. They certainly make people feel more confident about facing their fears.
Are there any resources for individuals that may be struggling with anxiety?
There are. I'm going to mention three organizations that have excellent websites with good information. There's a lot of bad information out there. These mm-hmm. websites they'll do you right. And one is the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, ADAA.org. And you can find information about finding a therapist if you need help. Also, lots of good information about problems with anxiety or anxiety disorders. There's also the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies. That's ABCT.org. Same thing. Find a therapist, read up on all sorts of information, lots of good statistics and facts and all that. And then the last one, for people who have obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a type of problem with anxiety, the International OCD Foundation, IOCDF.org. Wonderful resources for folks.
Well, that's all very helpful information. John, thank you so much for your time.
You bet.
So very similar advice to Sheryl Sandberg there, huh? We're leaning in.
Absolutely.
It brings to mind like an image of a dad teaching his child to swim by just being like, jump in the pool, figure it out.
Yeah. When you come down from an anxiety attack, you always think exactly what you two were talking about. Oh, it wasn't that bad. I mean, obviously there's going to be some time when you're on an airplane where there could be the worst turbulence of all time. Mm-hmm. And then when you land, you're like, well, thank God that's over. But for the most part, a flight will usually be okay. And like, that's a fear that a lot of people have. I don't mind flying, but when the like cabin starts to go up and down and all over the place, then you're like, okay, I'm going to like put my seatbelt back on here.
Right.
Not that that will help anything.
Tighten it back up. Yeah. Right.
When it's over, I always find myself like, oh, that wasn't half bad. And it's the same thing with what he was saying about playing with a dog if you're afraid of dogs, which right. When I was a kid, I used to be afraid of dogs. And now as an adult, you just got to pet them and love them.
Nice. So just like over time and like exposure to dogs.
Absolutely.
Think about it. You feel better.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Well, I'm curious, as we begin to wrap up here, what are your takeaways, if you have anything related to anxiety?
I think that a lot of it is stuff that I've heard from my own doctor, but it's always good to hear a fresh perspective, and it's a good reminder. Hey, it's not all terrible. I did like what he said about the exposure therapy and relating things in the most basic terms, right? Because that always helps, just so that all parties can understand it.
Totally. Sometimes with anything medical, it can feel like things are just going over your head as you're trying to figure it out and get a grasp on it. And that in and of itself can give you anxiety. But yeah, he does a really good job of
breaking everything down.
Right. And what you had mentioned in the interview is that he talks about it in a very positive light.
Yeah.
I think that's helpful too. Like, you're not the only one that has anxiety. There are so many other people that have this problem. And the best thing you can do, I think, is to talk to somebody about it, whether it be like a friend or a family member, a therapist. I think that it is very helpful to just like tell somebody what you're feeling. Somebody that obviously who you trust and know.
Yeah. Right. Just a guy taking your order at Starbucks. Yes.
Yeah. Real a tough day.
Right. Dylan, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you on social media?
You can go on Instagram. You can look me up at Dylan Geislers. You can go on Twitter at Dylan_Martin.
Well, Dylan, thank you again. This has been great.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed episode one. Just wanted to say a thank you to our sponsors, My Software Tutor and the Cardis Studio. Don't forget to rate and review the show and check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. My other podcast, Death Space Filling the Void. And if you have an idea of something that you're afraid of or nervous about or anxious about that you think we should talk about and turn into an episode, please reach out. It'd be so fun to hear from you. You can get me at the social media accounts or thatgivesmeanxietypodcast@gmail.com. All right. Thank you so much for listening.